Hello. I was wondering this a couple of days ago. How was your first time like?
It's funny you should ask. I was just thinking about that actually. I think it was with my parents.
Oh yeah, me too.
Ah,
Same,
cool.
yeah.
Yeah, like it was quite special. I remember it, like,
Yeah, you never really forget the first time you eat sushi.
exactly. Yeah. It was very like that time it was like special. It was like a special occasion. It was like a special restaurant. It was like more on like not fine dining, but it was definitely something special.
Yeah, but for me it was like at my parents' house when I was, I don't know, 6 or 5. It was this whole thing where I believed that sushi was only for adults.
So it was like at home.
Yeah, they would make
Oh, it was
sushi at
takeout.
home.
Oh, they
No,
would make
they would
it.
make it. Yeah, they
Okay,
would have
okay.
like these, I don't know, dinner parties with their friends, and I would think that the only way that you can be an adult is if you eat sushi. So I learned how to eat with chopsticks when I was like in kindergarten because I wanted to be an adult. I was like the only child of the friend group, so I wanted to be a grown up. Not anymore though. I mean, I really regret that thought one
Who
day.
does? Hello everyone, I'm Marco.
And I'm Tamar.
And this is
Once Upon a Sushi.
So, we make this podcast for our course, History of Food in Modern and Contemporary Times. And we chose to talk about the history of sushi. So, just want to explain really quick what we did, how we did it. We are a group of 7 people. We split up in 3 teams. We have our research team that scoured the world's ocean of information to select just the best pieces of information. We have our recording and editing and music team
The
that
geeks.
the geeks, exactly, the ones who are gonna put this in the form that you are listening to now, and us too, that are gonna talk
Her
and
head's off.
yeah, we're gonna put all the information in your head so you will never forget it, hopefully.
Hopefully. We decided to structure this in sort of a conversational way. We read all the information. We're gonna read it. We're gonna talk about it. And we've divided into 4 parts. We're gonna start by talking a bit about the origin, the history of sushi, and then we're gonna talk about gender roles, and we're gonna talk about overfishing. So stay with us. So we want to start with the origin. Sushi is very old, apparently.
How old?
Very old. It started in the 4th century. It actually started in Southeast Asia. Which a lot of people say sushi is Japanese, which obviously it got famous and is very widespread in Japan, but it actually started in the paddy fields in China in the 4th century, as I said before. People, they preserved fish by fermenting them with salt and rice, and actually they threw away the rice right after the fermentation. They didn't use the rice for eating, they only used it for fermenting it.
So in the beginning, sushi was not rice and fish, it was just fish.
No, it was just fish. It was called, let me, nare sushi.
Nare
Nare sushi. Sushi is an adjective meaning something sour.
So it was like the fermentation made it sour, and that was
Yeah,
like the sour
exactly.
fish.
Very smelly fermented fish, basically.
Sounds amazing.
So later, this technique of preserving fish was introduced in Japan in the 8th century. And also, what I found very interesting was the taboo around consuming meat. And like, there is a Buddhist prohibition of killing and Shinto taboo against consumption of animal flesh.
Like Buddhism in Japan.
Yeah.
And what is Shinto?
I don't know.
I know.
Then
So
say
the
it.
Shinto is like the belief system that existed in Japan before Buddhism. So it was like it predates historic records. That it's a multi like they had many gods, and it was like very nature spirit based. So That's why there was the taboo of eating animals, because they were considered like spirits.
Cool. The animals were considered spirits.
Yeah, they could be considered spirits, and like all spirits had animal forms, so that was very important.
Oh.
Fun fact!
If you want to be a fun fact.
Did you know that Shinto religion is still present in Japan and rice is sacred? It's called shari, tiny pieces of Buddha's bones. And each grain of rice is meant to contain 7 spirits. So when you eat a piece of sushi, you're eating a whole bunch of spirits. And wasting that rice, it's really bad for the Shinto religion.
But how that is like so crazy with the how what we talked about before. I mean, throwing away the rice in before that.
Yeah, but that was in China.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, even afterwards in Japan also they did that.
They did
throwing away all the spirits. They didn't care about the spirits.
Interesting.
So I'm never ever throwing a piece of sushi again. Sushi. after that, in 675 AD, Emperor Tamu issued a decree prohibiting the eating of cattle, horses, dogs, monkeys, and chickens.
So all the nice animals to eat.
All the pretty animals to eat. But fish, however, it was specifically excluded from the meat taboo and encouraging the Japanese to exploit marine resources creatively. So, which basically meant that they now have a very good reason to start eating a lot of fish because they were looking for a different source of protein.
And they still did it in the fermented form.
Yes, still did it in the fermented form. And after that, after the era of fermentation, we go into some different ways of fermentation. For example, in the Azuki Monoyama period, which is 1500 to 1600, there was the invention of namanari, which is half-made sushi. It's a type of sushi that was fermented for a much shorter time. The earlier years of sushi rice fermentation were not known for yielding odors that were pleasing to the senses. They basically smelled like cheese and fish, which is disgusting to think about.
It sounds disgusting. So what's the why behind that? Like, what's the reason behind of the change? Was it they want like shorter time?
Exactly, shorter time. They wanted to ferment it for a much shorter time than they were used to before, and also they wanted to kind of make it smell better, just for it to be nicer to have around, because people had a big problem with this disgusting odor.
Was it perceived as disgusting back then, or is it just us who thinks that it's disgusting because we have a different palate now?
I mean, obviously, this is a hard question because I've never talked to someone who lived in 1500, 1600, but when they write about in the scriptures, if they talk about this odor, it means that it was present. You know, people were talking about this odor.
Say what? Fun fact? Did you know that the carp fish that was fermented originally for a long time is still made in Japan? It's actually called funazushi. And in the Shiga prefecture, the fish is fished in Lake Biwa and is fished during the spring and is not consumed until New Year. So you can actually still find that parmesan tasting cheese.
Would you eat that?
I would try it.
Would you eat that?
I would try it, definitely.
I'm not sure. I feel like I would say I would try that, but I think the minute it hits my nose, I would be like, no, thank you. I will eat either cheese or fish, but not, you know.
Both.
Not fish smelling cheese.
It's like in Italy, you don't put parmesan on fish pasta.
Don't you start with that, don't you? Me and you are not Italian, we can't even go there. I'm scared. I'm shaking.
So actually, there is a fun little story from that period. It's about a woman who was selling this nare sushi on the side of the street. And there is a man who comes up the street and he sees her and she's passed out drunk. Like, she's laying next to her bucket of nare sushi and she's drunk. And he goes his way, and a few hours later, comes back, he goes down the same street, he sees this lady vomiting into the bucket, And instead of throwing it away, she just stirs the bucket.
No, please stop.
Stirs it around and keeps on selling it. So that story that, like, when I found it, I was like, what the fuck? But that shows, like, that probably the smell was, like, not really, like, agreeable. Like, not very nice.
Or it shows what a great businesswoman she was.
Also, I mean, women in business.
Yeah, exactly. Women supporting women.
Definitely.
This reminds me that I forgot to say this before, but regarding the amount of time that you need to ferment actually this fish, the Japanese acquired the practice that came from China. They would put the fish, clean fish, between rice and salt, between two heavy stones, and they would let it sit for a few weeks, and then they would use lighter and lighter stones to ferment it, and this could take up to a year or more.
And they put it in barrels?
Yeah.
That's interesting. That reminds me of the, like, the colatura di alici that they do in Campania.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
That is, like, it's not fermented because there's so much salt, but it's, like, salt, anchovies, salt, anchovies, salt, anchovies in a barrel pressed with a stone for three years.
Yeah.
So it's the same image.
It's the same image. I bet it's the same smell as well.
No, because it's not fermented. It's just, in the end, the colatura is just like the dissolved fish. It's like an essence of fish.
Oh, cool.
So it's not the smelly fermented stuff.
So I think, you know, when you use things like this in order to consume, you need to find a better way, time-wise, to make people be able to buy these things. So when we're going back to what I said before, in the Azuki Manui Maya period, with the half-made sushi, they would actually have, in the vendors would put out signs telling exactly the customer when the sushi will be ready. So you would have a sign saying, in 3 months, you know, come eat. And people would be waiting for these dates in order to come and consume this sushi. Which I think is crazy. I mean, how much consumerism has changed. No one would wait right now for this kind of thing, right?
Oh, no, never.
And think about it, waiting like a year for a fermented, fishy, cheesy, smelly, like...
Must have been very good.
If she throws up and eats it again, you know, it must have been extremely good. Okay, so this is where it gets super complicated. So we have our specialist here who's gonna explain this bit.
Okay, we need to say that already in the research this is complicated because different sources give us different time frames of when this whole process started and ended. But basically in Japan they were trying to shorten the fermentation time. They wanted the sushi ready earlier. So at first, they started introducing sake in the rice because alcohol is the base for the process of vinegarization. So they were turning the rice sour faster by adding an half process already alcohol. And then to make it even faster, they started adding vinegar to the process, and that really sped it up. And it said that it was the first one to add vinegar in the rice was this man called Matsumoto Yoshichi, I believe, I'm not sure.
That was amazing.
Somewhere around the mid 17th century. After that, to make it even faster, because at this point the fish was still kept inside the rice with the vinegar.
Like how long?
Sour. This was a matter of weeks.
Okay.
Because vinegar is already the final product.
So we went from years to months to weeks.
Exactly. And then the final part of this process was not fermenting the fish, but adding the vinegar to mimic that sour fermented flavor to the rice directly once the rice was cooked.
So again, we went from years to months to weeks to days to the same day, which I guess is like the thing that most is similar to what we know now.
Yeah, because now when we talk about sushi, we mostly talk about freshness, which is something completely different than what the origin of sushi used to be.
The fermented
exactly,
sushi.
Exactly. So this is where we conclude our origin story, and we're going to modern time of sushi. This is where I move the mic to you, Marco.
Thank you, darling.
You're welcome.
So if we talk about the story of modern sushi, we are talking about nigiri sushi. And it can be traced back to a sushi chef. He was called Hanaya Yohe, who in 1824 invented nigiri sushi. At least that's what the story says. It's the he had a shop called Yohe Sushi, and in this shop the nigiri sushi appears for the first time. However, there are mentions earlier than that that talk about the same same style of sushi, and his son actually was the one that later talked about the story of the invention of the sushi. So it might be true, it might not be true, but in the research we found the exact date. So
can you explain what nigiri sushi is for
Yeah, of course. The nigiri sushi is the nigiri that we know today. It's mm-hmm. a piece of fish, the sashimi. The sashimi is only the piece of fish, mm-hmm. Pressed onto a ball of rice. And actually this pressing, or actually gripping, nigiri means nigiru in Japanese means gripping.
So like the rock that we talked about before.
It's like the stone that mm-hmm. was used to press down the sushi in the box, in the barrel. Because later they changed it, and they had ready made boxes, like takeaway boxes with nigiri sushi that was pressed with a stone. And he, instead of pressing it with stone, he pressed it with his hand and sold it right away. And yeah, as I was saying,
it's so much more appealing than the sushi that we talked about before. I
mean, yeah, it's no fat for fermentation anymore. Yeah, no, yeah. You just have the piece of rice, you have the piece of fish, and you press it together to make the nigiri sushi. Did I say that the nigiru means gripping? No?
Yes, yes.
So and actually you use this verb to describe that you make sushi. So actually, like, you don't make sushi, you grip sushi. That's like, it's a...
Hey, what are you doing? You want to grip sushi later?
Yeah, kind of.
That's going to be the new,
exactly.
The new terminology.
And it came from this box sushi that I was talking about, no? And another element that we can find in this box sushi that we might know now is the bamboo leaves that were used to separate the different sushis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same that we now in takeaway sushi find, like the plastic green stuff, which actually in Japan is also an art form to cut bamboo leaves with knives to make like very ornate leaves, like with like houses and animals and stuff like that.
Cool.
So to separate the sushi.
We're not even talking about seaweed yet. Like, we're not even
No,
there.
There's no seaweed. There's no seaweed at all. So yeah, this is like the innovation that was obviously like made for instant consumption. So mm-hmm. that was like a big change, no? So we are in the Edo period. So we are in the 1800s. And in this period, also like almost the same as in Europe with industrialization, we have a phenomenon that unfortunately there's no real word in English for it, but...
Of course we're gonna
Of course that. There is a German word for it.
Oh my god. I was like, he's gonna say Japanese, but how did we get to Germany now?
Well, so in Germany during the industrialization, there was the phenomenon of Landflucht. Which, if you translate it literally, it means country flight. So, fleeing from the countryside. In Japan, this was also the case. Like, life in the countryside was hard. There was not a lot of work. You go to the city to find work. So, all of a sudden, we have all these workers moving to the city. And what also changes is the system of work. You go to work, you get paid, you get a wage. What do you do with your wage? You go out and you spend it, no? And this is how we come to like a kind of a nightlife style where workers at night would go out and then they would consume many different things, of course, but also sushi.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have, on one part, we have fine dining sushi, which is like the sushi chef who like makes your sushi, and you sit down and you eat. It's a very formal.
So it's a more of a restaurant style. So we move from like stalls of barrels of sushi to restaurant style sushi.
Exactly. And it's also like a very formalized thing, of course. We're still in Japan. And so but on the other hand, we have the food stalls. We have food stalls on the street that sell the nigiri sushi.
Mm-hmm.
And it it's even like there's a poem in 1827 that even talks about like the hand gesture of the gripping of the sushi in a way that like it compares it to a dance or to a martial art.
Ah, cool.
So it's like, so this is actually like how we know that also they used it in this period. So now we're in the period where sushi really becomes fast food.
Mm-hmm.
And this might be, in the whole history of sushi, the biggest revolution of sushi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like sushi as we know.
Eine lustige Tatsache.
Did you know a little fun fact about the sushi stalls, right? The first sushi shops. Do you know many times now when you see on TVs and in animes, sushi shops have a little square tissue attached to the outside of the shop,
like a curtain.
It looks like a curtain, but in reality it's a cloth. That is the modern representation of an old tradition, which was to put a newspaper hanging outside the shop, because sushi is meant to be eaten with your hands.
Uh-huh.
So you go inside the shop, eat the sushi, and as you were leaving, clean your hands on the newspaper.
Wipe your hands on.
Now the customers knew that when they were choosing the sushi shop where they were going to have their food, they were going for the dirtiest newspaper or clothes, because it was the most popular.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me like in Spain, there's a lot of shops where you find napkins all over the floor. And that's how you choose which one you're gonna know there's the best food.
Oh, it's like, so it's like an older TripAdvisor.
Exactly. Before TripAdvisor.
Before TripAdvisor, there was dirty newspaper.
It sounds so much better.
So, how do we know what kinds of fish they put on the nigiri sushi? The one main source that we have are the Morisada sketches. It's a collection of pictures of paintings that depict these nightlife scenes in Tokyo. And from there, we can see the toppings of the nigiri sushi, which were mainly tamagoyaki, which is the omelette.
Yeah.
We have prawns. We have shirao, which is ice fish. We have gizzard shad. We have conger eel. And we have tuna. We're going to talk about the tuna more later.
I'm just thinking about the person who's looking at these drawings and trying to decipher, oh, you know, this is a gizzard.
Yeah.
You just said.
Exactly. And it was also, I was thinking about our other history course that we had, where we were talking about looking at pictures and trying to get information from them.
Yeah.
So I actually think that maybe we need to be careful with the interpretation of these pictures.
Yeah,
because of course. Because of course you would want to paint the most beautiful nigiri.
Mm-hmm.
Not like some ugly fish on a nigiri,
yeah.
So you choose the one that looks best.
That's true.
To also maybe, I don't know, maybe he just drew the prawns to to put some color in the picture.
Like Victoria's Secret sushi.
But this is the sources that we have, and this is like what we know now.
Mm-hmm.
Also, now with the different kinds of fish, we have the use of wasabi. We have with the tuna and the gizzard shad, we have the use of wasabi because it's antimicrobial,
mm-hmm.
which we don't, I mean, obviously they didn't know the scientific reason, but they connected the dots of like use of wasabi and less food poisoning.
Fatto divertente.
By the way, did you know that wasabi nowadays is actually a paste made out of a powder, which is horseradish? Originally, wasabi is only native to Japan and Sakhalin Island, which is a Russian outpost off Japan's northern coast. And there are sources of foraging wild wasabi since the 10th century.
So wait, but horseradish is not green, so they color it?
Yeah, they add food coloring to
really?
It.
Really?
Yeah.
That is deception.
That is mind-blowing. But also, does that mean that, you know, if the wasabi is not coming from Japan, then it's horseradish for sure?
Yes, definitely. So it's if it's like cheap, no? Like because obviously the real wasabi is very expensive.
But I wonder what the rules about calling it wasabi or not.
Well, obviously there are none because everyone is calling it wasabi.
That's interesting.
It's not protected.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Because like champagne fucking sues... Oh, I'm not supposed to curse. Sues everyone who even thinks about using the word champagne, but wasabi can be horseradish and no one cares.
Maybe we should change that.
I'm going on a hunt to find the wasabi killers.
So that's interesting. And what we also know about the ingredients that they now use on the nigiri sushi is that some of them are treated. We have boiled, salted... we have vinegar treated or a combination of all three of those, and these treatments actually made it so that there was no use for soy sauce. So at this point we don't have yet the use of soy sauce mm-hmm. with sushi. So I was saying that we are in the Edo period. Edo was actually the old name of Tokyo. So it's not only are we talking in what period we are with the nigiri sushi, it's also geographically. Like it started in Edo, Tokyo. And you can still nowadays see the name Edomae in many sushi restaurants. Even if it's not in Tokyo, even outside of Tokyo, outside of Japan, mm-hmm. which means like the Edomae means in front of the bay, the body of water in front of Tokyo, where they fished the fish mm-hmm. for the nigiri sushi. So what we have now at these food stands is a selection of nigiri. You go there, you choose your favorite, and this is actually like very similar to what we have now, what was invented later, the Kaiten Sushi, which is the sushi restaurant that has the conveyor belt that goes around, and where you also you choose your favorite sushi. Now these concepts have one problem. Obviously there's gonna be some pieces that are less preferable, that people maybe don't like as much, so you have waste. And that's when we also get into the made-to-order nigiri sushi. So it's much more sustainable if you don't have to throw it all away.
So we're talking about the time period like 1800?
Yeah, but we're now in the end of the Edo period.
Okay.
And we move from just putting the nigiri sushi there and have people choose to making it for them as they come into the shop.
Mm-hmm.
And since so Tokyo is the capital, this is also so, okay, let me say, go back just one bit.
Mm-hmm.
In the period where Tokyo was made capital, because it wasn't before,
okay,
the nigiri starts to spread. Because now Tokyo being the capital, it's also like the capital of the culture. It's the capital of everything Japanese. Also, like the Tokyo dialect is spreading as the official Japanese. This is one of the factors why the nigiri spread. We have two other ones. One is the Great Kanto Earthquake, which was in the 1920s, I think. It was a very big earthquake that destroyed big parts of Tokyo. And because there were at that time many workers from other parts of Japan living in Tokyo, their houses were destroyed, so they went back to their hometowns, mm-hmm. taking with them the nigiri. So there we have a first spread of nigiri. The second spread of nigiri is ironically because of the defeat of the Japanese by the United States after the Second World War. Because of rationing, there was a law. It was called the Emergency Restaurant Business Measures Ordinance.
Oh my god.
Beautiful name.
Mouthful.
And it basically closed all the restaurants. So because there was rationing and because there was not enough food, they said, we close all the restaurants. We can't afford this. Now, there was a sushi union, a sushi maker union, and they lobbied the government to implement this really like ingenious rule. Instead of going to the shops and buying sushi, the people would go to the shops, bring rice that they would receive as a ration. They would go to the shops and they would trade their rice for sushi. They would pay a little bit on top, of course, but it wasn't like buying food, it was a processing fee. And the sushi restaurants became commissioned manufacturers. So that's like the loophole they created to deal with this emergency restaurant business measures ordinance.
Yeah, it's kind of like if we go back to what we talked about before in the origin story, of when they were talking about the prohibition of meat and they had to find a different solution for it.
Yeah, people always find a way around rules, no?
Yeah.
And so now you have to imagine that in that period, there was no restaurant in the whole of Japan except for sushi restaurants. So you can imagine what that did for the spread of sushi and for like the popularity of sushi. From that period, or like a little bit before, we can also start to see the global spread of sushi. We are now in the Meiji period, in the end of the Edo period, in the end of the 1900s, and we see a migration of Japanese people outside of Japan. Mostly, they migrate to the United States. And in a very short period of time, a lot of people migrate to LA. We have in 1900, 200 Japanese people living in LA. And then 20 years later, we're already at 15,000.
Wow.
And there's notes of the first Japanese restaurant, sushi restaurant, in 1906 in LA. But it would take much longer for sushi to get into the mainstream culture of the US. In the beginning, it was Japanese restaurants were for Japanese people. We see sushi entering the US mainstream in the 1970s as a healthy food choice, as a stylish food choice, even. It was very elegant.
Yeah.
And what we see here, of course, we see an adaptation of the nigiri sushi to the American market, with the most notorious example being the California roll, which is, we haven't talked about the maki sushi yet.
No, I was waiting for when the seaweed is coming into the story.
Yeah, exactly. So we have the maki sushi, which is the roll that has the seaweed outside of it, like kind of a packaging.
Mm-hmm.
And the California roll was actually made because for Americans, the idea of eating seaweed was not as appetizing. Mm-hmm. So, very smart sushi chefs, that's a hard word,
sushi chef.
They invented the California roll and to hide the seaweed inside. So they would put the rice outside and the seaweed and then the ingredients. Oh, and another thing that changed is the size of the nigiri. So before we had like double the size of rice that we know now, and it became like this bite-sized thing. But also the maki sushi, you know, is also, we know it as a bite size.
Mm-hmm.
And to talk more about like the seaweed, I would like to invite our expert again. So Walter, what is there to know about the seaweed?
Right, very briefly, in Japan, seaweed has been eaten for a long time, like 2,000 years, but for a long time it was a rare product. So the seaweed that we eat, the nori, is a lava seaweed, a red seaweed. Normally they will find it on the shore after a storm and then collect it and use it for food. So it was very expensive. It was a luxury food.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, that's the only way it was consumed. Then they started trying to reproduce the seaweed around the 1600, but it was very complicated. They couldn't crack the way to reproduce the seaweed. So the yields were very low. Maybe one yield was good and then the next one was bad. And the seaweed was produced in a paper district of Tokyo at the time. That's why it's got that paper look to it.
Cool.
But then a British botanist named, I can't remember right now.
He has a name.
I'll find it. Oh, yes. Kathleen Drew Baker.
Now she has a name.
Oh, she has a name.
There we go.
She moved from the UK to Japan and she discovered how to reproduce seaweed. Exactly the lava seaweed that you need to produce nori. And that's when the actual industry of nori production boomed and it became much lower in price and it spread.
So what time period are we talking about?
This is 1949.
Okay,
so until that point we don't have maki sushi at all.
You can find maki from the sparsely produced seaweed.
Okay,
but it was still a very expensive.
It was a luxury product.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Y ahora algo divertido.
By the way, did you know that the nori seaweed that we eat today is actually not the seaweed itself, but it's the reproducing organs of the seaweed?
Wait, what?
Exactly. So actually, we're eating the reproduction organs of the seaweed, but now in comparison, their reproductive organs, if you would compare them to a human one, would be that we would have a penis the size of a skyscraper. Like, the ratio there is crazy.
That's a very nice image.
Yeah.
So that concludes the modern part of the history of sushi. We talked about origin, we talked about, as I said, the modern part. And that concludes our first episode. Thank you for listening and be sure to tune in for our second episode. We're going to talk about the women's role in sushi. We're going to talk about
women power,
overfishing. The chapter actually is called Many Fish, Few Fish. I love this title.
Yeah, very good name.
So thanks again and see you next time.
Bye.